a demented song rises up. It is like the signal that announces the close of the exchange. What hopes there were are swept up. The moment has come to void the last bagful of urine. The day is sneaking in, like a leper. One of the things to guard against when you work nights is not to break your schedule. If you don't get to bed before the birds begin to screech, it's useless to go to bed at all. This morning, having nothing better to do, I visit the Jardin des Plantes. Marvelous pelicans here from Chapultepec and peacocks with studded fans that look at you with silly eyes. Suddenly it began to rain. Returning to Montparnasse in the bus, I noticed a little French woman opposite me who sat stiff and erect as if she were getting ready to preen herself. She sat on the edge of the seat as if she feared to crush her gorgeous tail. Marvelous, I thought, if suddenly she shook herself and from her derriere there sprung open a huge studded fan with long silken plumes. At the Café de l'Avenue, where I stop for a bite, a woman with a swollen stomach tries to interest me in her condition. She would like me to go to a room with her and while away an hour or two. It is the first time I have ever been propositioned by a pregnant woman. I am almost tempted to try it. As soon as the baby is born and handed over to the authorities, she will go back to her trade, she says. She makes hats. Observing that my interest is waning, she takes my hand and puts it on her abdomen. I feel something stirring inside. It takes my appetite away. I have never seen a place like Paris for varieties of sexual provender. As soon as a woman loses a front tooth or an eye or a leg, she goes on the loose. In America, she'd starve to death if she had nothing to recommend her but a mutilation. Here it is different. A missing tooth or a nose eaten away or a fallen womb, any misfortune that aggravates the natural homeliness of the female, seems to be regarded as an added spice, a stimulant for the jaded appetites of the male. I am speaking naturally of that world which is peculiar to the big cities, the world of men and women whose last drop of juice has been squeezed out by the machine, the martyrs of modern progress. It is this mass of bones and collar buttons which the painter finds so difficult to put flesh on. It is only later in the afternoon when I find myself in an art gallery on the Rue de Sèze, surrounded by the men and women of Matisse, that I am drawn back again to the proper precincts of the human world. On the threshold of that big hall, whose walls are now ablaze, I pause a moment to recover from the shock which one experiences when the habitual gray of the world is rent asunder and the color of life splashes forth in song and poem. I find myself in a world so natural, so complete, that I am lost. I have the sensation of being immersed in the very plexus of life, focal from whatever place, position, or attitude I take my stance. Lost as when once I sank into the quick of a budding grove and seated in the dining room of that enormous world of Baalbek, I caught for the first time the profound meaning of those interior stills which manifest their presence through the exorcism of sight and touch. Standing on the threshold of that world which Matisse has created, I re-experienced the power of that revelation which had permitted Proust to so deform the picture of life that only those who, like himself, are sensible to the alchemy of sound and sense, are capable of transforming the negative reality of life into the substantial and significant outlines of art. Only those who can admit the light into their gizzards can translate what is there in the heart. Vividly now, I recall how the glint and sparkle of light, caroming from the massive chandeliers, splintered and ran blood, flecking the tips of the waves that beat monotonously on the dull gold outside the windows. On the beach, masts and chimneys interlaced, and like a fuliginous shadow, the figure of Albertine gliding through the surf, fusing into the mysterious quick and prism of a protoplasmic realm, uniting her shadow to the dream and harbinger of death. With the close of day, pain rising like a mist from the earth, sorrow closing in, shuttering the endless vista of sea and sky. Two waxen hands lying listlessly on the bedspread, and along the pale veins the fluted murmur of a shell, repeating the legend of its birth. In every poem by Matisse there is the history of a particle of human flesh which refused the consummation of death, The whole run of flesh, from hair to nails, expresses the miracle of breathing, as if the inner eye, in its thirst for a greater reality, had converted the pores of the flesh into hungry, seeing mouths. By whatever vision one passes, there is the odor and the sound of voyage. It is impossible to gaze at even a corner of his dreams without feeling the lift of the wave and the cool of flying spray. He stands at the helm, peering with steady blue eyes into the portfolio of time. Into what distant corners has he not thrown his long, slanting gaze? Looking down the vast promontory of his nose, he has beheld everything. The Cordilleras falling away into the Pacific. The history of the diaspora done in vellum, shutters fluting the frou-frou of the beach, the piano curving like a conch, corollas giving out diapasons of light, chameleons squirming under the book press, seraglios expiring in oceans of dust, music issuing like fire from the hidden chromosphere of pain, spore and madrepore fructifying the earth, navels vomiting their bright spawn of anguish. He is a bright sage, a dancing seer, who with a sweep of the brush removes the ugly scaffold to which the body of man is chained by the incontrovertible facts of life. He it is, if any man today possesses the gift, who knows where to dissolve the human figure, who has the courage to sacrifice an harmonious line in order to detect the rhythm and murmur of the blood, who takes the light that has been refracted inside him and lets it flood the keyboard of color. Behind the minutiae, the chaos, the mockery of life, he detects the invisible pattern. He announces his discoveries in the metaphysical pigment of space. No searching for formulae, no crucifixion of ideas, no compulsion other than to create. Even as the world goes to smash, there is one man who remains at the core, who becomes more solidly fixed and anchored, more centrifugal as the process of dissolution quickens. More and more the world resembles an entomologist's dream. The earth is moving out of its orbit. The axis has shifted. From the north, the snow blows down in huge knife-blue drifts. A new ice age is setting in, the transverse sutures are closing up, and everywhere throughout the corn belt, the fetal world is dying, turning to dead mastoid. Inch by inch, the deltas are drying out, and the riverbeds are smooth as glass. A new day is dawning, a metallurgical day, when the earth shall clink with showers of bright yellow ore. As the thermometer drops, the form of the world grows blurred. Osmosis there still is, and here and there articulation, but at the periphery, the veins are all varicose. At the periphery, the light waves bend, and the sun bleeds like a broken rectum. At the very hub of this wheel, which is falling apart, is Matisse, and he will keep on rolling until everything that has gone to make up the wheel has disintegrated. He has already rolled over a goodly portion of the globe, over Persia and India and China, and like a magnet he has attached to himself microscopic particles from Kurd, Baluchistan, Timbuktu, Somaliland, Angkor, Tierra del Fuego. The odalisks he has studded with malachite and jasper, their flesh veiled with a thousand eyes, perfumed eyes dipped in the sperm of whales. Wherever a breeze stirs, there are breasts as cool as jelly. White pigeons come to flutter and rut in the ice-blue veins of the Himalayas. The wallpaper with which the men of science have covered the world of reality is falling to tatters. The grand whorehouse which they have made of life requires no decoration. It is essential only that the drains function adequately. Beauty, that feline beauty which has us by the balls in America, is finished. To fathom the new reality, it is first necessary to dismantle the drains, to lay open the gangrened ducts which compose the genitourinary system that supplies the excreta of art. The odor of the day is permanganate and formaldehyde. The drains are clogged with strangled embryos. The world of Matisse is still beautiful in an old-fashioned bedroom way. There is not a ball bearing in evidence, nor a boilerplate, nor a piston, nor a monkey wrench. It is the same old world that went gaily to the Bois in the pastoral days of wine and fornication. I find it soothing and refreshing to move amongst these creatures with live, breathing pores whose background is stable and solid as light itself. I feel it poignantly when I walk along the Boulevard de la Madeleine and the whores rustle beside me, when just a glance at them causes me to tremble. Is it because they are exotic or well-nourished? No, it is rare to find a beautiful woman along the Boulevard de la Madeleine. But in Matisse, in the exploration of his brush, there is the trembling glitter of a world which demands only the presence of the female to crystallize the most fugitive aspirations. To come upon a woman offering herself outside a urinal where there are advertised cigarette papers, rum, acrobats, horse races, where the heavy foliage of the trees breaks the heavy mass of walls and roofs, is an experience that begins where the boundaries of the known world leave off. In the evening now and then, skirting the cemetery walls, I stumble upon the phantom odalisques of Matisse fastened to the trees, their tangled manes drenched with sap. A few feet away, removed by incalculable eons of time, lies the prone and mummy-swathed ghost of Baudelaire, of a whole world that will belch no more. In the dusky corners of cafes are men and women with hands locked, their loins slather-flecked. Nearby stands the garçon, with his apron full of sous, waiting patiently for the entr'acte in order to fall upon his wife and gouge her. Even as the world falls apart, the Paris that belongs to Matisse shudders with bright, gasping orgasms. The air itself is steady with a stagnant sperm, the trees tangled like hair. On its wobbly axle, the wheel rolls steadily downhill. There are no brakes, no ball bearings, no balloon tires. The wheel is falling apart, but the revolution is intact. Out of a clear sky there comes one day a letter from Boris, whom I have not seen for months and months. It is a strange document, and I don't pretend to understand it all clearly. What happened between us, at any rate, as far as I go, is that you touched me, touched my life, that is, at the one point where I am still alive, my death. By the emotional flow, I went through another immersion. I lived again, alive. No longer by reminiscence, as I do with others, but alive. That's how it began. Not a word of greeting, no date, no address. Written in a thin, pompous scrawl on ruled paper torn out of a blank book. That is why, whether you like me or not, deep down I rather think you hate me. You are very close to me. But you know I know how I died. I see myself dying again. I am dying. That is something. More than to be dead, simply. That may be the reason why I am so afraid to see you. You may have played the trick on me and died. Things happen so fast nowadays. I'm reading it over, line by line, standing by the stones. It sounds nutty to me. All this palaver about life and death and things happening so fast. Nothing is happening that I can see except the usual calamities on the front page. He's been living all by himself for the last 6 months, tucked away in a cheap little room, probably holding telepathic communication with Kronstadt. He talks about the line falling back, the sector evacuated, and so on and so forth, as though he were dug into a trench and writing a report to headquarters. He probably had his frock coat on when he sat down to pen this missive, and he probably rubbed his hands a few times as he used to do when a customer was calling to rent the apartment. "The reason I wanted you to commit suicide," he begins again. At that I burst out laughing. He used to walk up and down with one hand stuck in the tail flap of his frock coat at the Villa Borghese, or at Kronstadt's, wherever there was deck space, as it were, and reel off this nonsense about living and dying to his heart's content. I never understood a word of it, I must confess, but it was a good show, and, being a Gentile, I was naturally interested in what went on in that menagerie of a brain pan. Sometimes he would lie on his couch full length, exhausted by the surge of ideas that swept through his noodle. His feet just grazed the book rack where he kept his Plato and Spinoza. He couldn't understand why I had no use for them. I must say he made them sound interesting, though what it was all about I hadn't the least idea. Sometimes I would glance at a volume furtively to check up on these wild ideas which he imputed to them, but the connection was frail, tenuous. He had a language all his own, Boris. That is, when I had him alone. But when I listened to Kronstadt, it seemed to me that Boris had plagiarized his wonderful ideas. They talked a sort of higher mathematics, these two. Nothing of flesh and blood ever crept in. It was weird, ghostly, ghoulishly abstract. When they got on to the dying business, it sounded a little more concrete. After all, a cleaver or a meat axe has to have a handle. I enjoyed those sessions immensely. It was the first time in my life that death had ever seemed fascinating to me, all these abstract deaths which involved a bloodless sort of agony. Now and then they would compliment me on being alive, but in such a way that I felt embarrassed. They made me feel that I was alive in the 19th century, a sort of atavistic remnant, a romantic shred, a soulful pithecanthropus erectus. Boris especially seemed to get a great kick out of touching me. He wanted me to be alive, so that he could die to his heart's content. You would think that all those millions in the street were nothing but dead cows, the way he looked at me and touched me. But the letter. I'm forgetting the letter. The reason why I wanted you to commit suicide that evening at the Kronstadts, when Moldorf became God, was that I was very close to you then, perhaps closer than I shall ever be, and I was afraid, terribly afraid, that someday you'd go back on me, die on my hands, and I would be left high and dry with my idea of you simply and nothing to sustain it. I should never forgive you for that. Perhaps you can visualize him saying a thing like that. Myself, it's not clear what his idea of me was, or at any rate, it's clear that I was just pure idea, an idea that kept itself alive without food. He never attached much importance, Boris, to the food problem. He tried to nourish me with ideas. Everything was idea. Just the same, when he had his heart set on renting the apartment, he wouldn't forget to put a new washer in the toilet. Anyway, he didn't want me to die on his hands. You must be life for me to the very end, so he writes. That is the only way in which you can sustain my idea of you. Because you have gotten, as you see, tied up with something so vital to me. I do not think I shall ever shake you off, nor do I wish to. I want you to live more vitally every day as I am dead. That is why when I speak of you to others, I am just a bit ashamed. It's hard to talk of oneself so intimately. You would imagine perhaps that he was anxious to see me, or that he would like to know what I was doing, but no, not a line about the concrete or the personal, except in this living-dying language, nothing but this little message from the trenches, this whiff of poison gas to apprise all and sundry that the war was still on. I sometimes ask myself how it happens that I attract nothing but crack-brained individuals, neurasthenics, neurotics, psychopaths, and Jews especially. There must be something in a healthy Gentile that excites the Jewish mind, like when he sees sour black bread. There was Moldorf, for example, who had made himself God, according to Boris and Kronstadt. He positively hated me, the little viper, yet he couldn't stay away from me. He came round regularly for his little dose of insults. It was like a tonic to him. In the beginning, it's true, I was lenient with him. After all, he was paying me to listen to him. And though I never displayed much sympathy, I knew how to be silent when it involved a meal and a little pin money. After a while, however, seeing what a masochist he was, I permitted myself to laugh in his face now and then. That was like a whip for him. It made the grief and agony gush forth with renewed vigor. And perhaps everything would have gone smoothly between us if he had not felt it his duty to protect Tanya. But Tanya being a Jewess, that brought up a moral question. He wanted me to stick to Mademoiselle Claude, for whom, I must admit, I had a genuine affection. He even gave me money occasionally to sleep with her, until he realized that I was a hopeless lecher. I mention Tanya now because she's just got back from Russia, just a few days ago. Sylvester remained behind to worm his way into a job. He's given up literature entirely. He's dedicated himself to the new utopia. Tanya wants me to go back there with her, to the Crimea preferably, and start a new life. We had a fine drinking bout up in Carl's room the other day, discussing the possibilities. I wanted to know what I could do for a living back there, if I could be a proofreader, for example. She said I didn't need to worry about what I would do. They would find a job for me as long as I was earnest and sincere. I tried to look earnest, but I only succeeded in looking pathetic. They don't want to see sad faces in Russia. They want you to be cheerful, enthusiastic, lighthearted, optimistic. It sounded very much like America to me.